After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Welcome to the Jack Kornfield Heart Wisdom Hour. We are delighted to share with you Jack's innate common sense wisdom and his clear, open heart. If you are interested in supporting Jack's podcast, go to BeHereNowNetwork.com/Jack.
I feel actually quite blessed. Teaching meditation is a good job. It is. You get to be with people at their best, or at least not at their worst, because they're quiet. It's true. And they ask about things that generally matter to them a lot. It's wonderful. I'd like to try and put a couple of things together this evening that I've been thinking about. And they are a bit disparate, so I'm not sure how they'll fit, but I'll give it a try. And I believe they even relate in some way to what we've talked about the past couple of weeks. And if they don't, then I'll rewrite the talk and we'll try some other week again. They have to do with inner meditation and outer child rearing. Somehow guiding the children in our life, outwardly and inwardly. Last week, someone came up to me afterwards, who had sat there, and said that they were a bit confused from what we talked about, that there was a kind of a mixed message. That in one way, in Buddhist practice and meditation, as we've been working with it for a long time, those who've been coming regularly, the main teachings are to let go, not to make anything or become anything, but really to learn how to let go in a graceful way from day to day and person to person and moment to moment and maybe even life to life. And what was confusing is that beside that message, there was also put out another message, which was to cultivate or to be able to create certain states of mind, happiness or love or loving kindness or compassion, rather than just letting go and taking things as they are. And it got even more exaggerated when I read that piece about kindergarten at the end of last time, which I heard in a particular way. And some other people heard very differently. For those who didn't hear it, this person said that all he really needed to learn as a grown-up, he learned in kindergarten, and it was simple things like share your toys and don't hit or put things back where you got them, flush and, you know, brush your teeth and stuff like that. And when I read it, the spirit for me was really that of simplicity, that practice or spiritual life or whatever was something that was very basic and very human and very immediate and not something esoteric or philosophical. But for some other people who heard it, it was like a whole list of parental do's and don'ts. Put your toys back where you found them, clean up afterwards, don't hit other kids. You know, brush your teeth when you're supposed to. And rather than being a process of letting go, it was kind of a new list of commandments. There's a very interesting story of a man who was dying coming to see Sariputra, I believe it was, one of the chief disciples of the Buddha. And Sariputra gave him, the man asked, how can you find love in your heart or in life? And Sariputra gave him an answer, which was a series of teachings on the development of loving kindness. And the man thanked him, and he did that, and he attained a great deal of loving kindness in his heart, and then he died. And Sariputra went back and told the Buddha about this, and it was in one of the rare times that, because he was a very fine teacher in his own right, Sariputra, that the Buddha admonished him and said, "You didn't do right by that man." And Sariputra said, "Why?" He asked to learn how to have love in his heart, and I taught him. And the Buddha said, "That wasn't enough. You didn't also teach him how to be free." And in some way, the loving kindness meditation, especially the kind that was taught in that circumstance or traditionally, it's very powerful, and it creates a sense of loving whoever you bring to mind, you develop until there's a state of happiness and well-being and love with them. It's kind of like candy in meditation. It's really good. But it's not really the love that can touch all things. It's not the love that can open to the whole of life and find freedom. It's the love that's love as opposed to, I don't know, disgruntlement or irritation or closedness of mind or heart. And so I thought about that and the questions that were raised about last week. And I started to think about child rearing. Because in a way, what we're doing is rearing our inner child, our spiritual child. Learning to nourish or love or discipline or whatever. And there's a certain balance in that. I want to read you something. It's a page and a half that was recently published in a very fine magazine called The Sun, which is published in North Carolina. It's kind of literary, psychological, spiritual journal called Hunches on Childhood by a psychologist in Washington State named Kent Hoffman. This is about children. And it's about 13 or 14 points he makes. One, I'm a psychologist. That is to say, I'm an archaeologist and a midwife to the human soul. And I believe after many years of doing this work that what happens in our earliest years has a radical and root effect on all that we experience thereafter. Two, we love because we were first love. Three, we fail to love because we ourselves were failed very early on. It is difficult to give what we didn't get. Four, our degree of openness to relationship, to the world around us, to others, to intimacy, is established in the first years of our life in relation to our parents and our family, in relation to our mother. Mothering is not supported in this culture. Mothering, nurturance, community, relationship is dangerous because it reminds us of our dependence and the limitations of the ones upon whom we were dependent. Five, the way we were treated as small children is the way we will treat ourselves and others the rest of our life, with tenderness and support, with neglect and cruelty, or with something in between. Six, Few of us have a batting average of even 2 hits out of 10 when it comes to treating ourselves with tenderness and support. 7. Each person is infinitely precious, of infinite worth, that is, worthy of infinite tenderness and support. Nowhere is this more obvious and apparent than in the life of a young child. 8. To have grown up in this industrialized society means that we are, each of us, wounded in ways that we do not yet comprehend. Unless we grieve and thus release these wounds, we will pass them on to the next generation. 9. The central wound of early childhood is abandonment. 10. Children are exceptionally sensitive, that is, fragile. Children, we, are also very resilient. Therein lies the problem. We do bounce back early on from woundings, and to the naked eye we appear to have gone on beyond the wound, and we have. We've also stayed right there at the scene of the crime. Depending on how deep the wound or abandonment, we will make certain that we return again and again and again until we can somehow get it right. 11. It is difficult to support children in a context that doesn't support us. Industrialized economy, financial anxiety, sexism, racism, meritocracy, dysfunctional families, aggression, ambition, not to mention genetics and acts of nature. All of these, as well as the painfully slow process of parents freeing themselves from their wounds of their past, interact. All of them affect the next generation. 12. In spite of our wounds, there is at our core a truth that cannot be extinguished. It has wisdom and tenacity and love. It can be lost and forgotten, but never destroyed. 13. Less violent cultures, Hopi, Sonoy, Eskimo, Kalahari, appear to prioritize early childhood practices that encourage confidence at the core of children. And thus they create a less violent society. 13. The future of the planet is, in part, dependent upon establishing the raising of healthy children as the central priority. And then lastly, the way we hold our children is the way we hold our future. There's a lot in that. I could well just stop with that and let you sit and reflect on it and think about it. The central wounds of our own childhood, of abandonment, of not being loved, that we look in our lives in so many ways, repeat, and look somehow to heal. And the capacities that we have in our life to create a healthy society or raise healthy children or have a healthy inner spiritual life based on that which we received or didn't from our past. In some way, our spiritual life is a rearing of an inner child. And there are several things that are needed, which may also be why there was a sense of 2 different messages last week. At least in one part there was. Primarily, we need to give attention and love and energy. It's called wise attention in Buddhist practice. We need to give attention to our inner child. Just as we need to give attention to anyone that we have in our charge as a child that we're trying to raise. When we asked the Dalai Lama, when we interviewed him, if he were to come and live in the West, what would he most want to do? And he said, set up a school for young children and raise them from the beginning to understand the heart of loving kindness and wisdom. Krishnamurti was asked what he felt was the most important thing, and he did in his 80 years or 90 years of his life and all of his teaching. And he said, start some schools for young children. And it's both literal and it's metaphorical. So the first thing that's needed is to give attention, to give love, to give energy. Without it, nothing flourishes. Children don't flourish, and our spiritual practice doesn't flourish unless we give it a lot of attention and care and energy and a lot of love. That's the foundation for it. It's not a practice of judgment or denial or beating your inner child. It doesn't get you very far spiritually. It doesn't raise a very healthy outer child either. Beside the giving of a loving and caring attention, the second thing that's necessary, which is a little bit its opposite, but not really, it's simply a different expression of love, is the setting of limits. You can't raise a healthy kid unless you can say no. And anybody who gets past 2 years old without saying no to their child is in real trouble. I mean, it gets very apparent. You see it at the playgrounds in the preschools. The parents who don't know how to set limits are up to their neck in alligators or whatever it is, in three-year-olds or four-year-olds. Inwardly, we also need to learn to set limits, which is learning to concentrate, learning to say a healthy no, to not indulge yourself in ways that are harmful or to get lost in things. And then when the choice comes, should I follow this further or is it time to really let go? To learn how to say no, to learn how to steady ourselves, to learn to create boundaries, to learn to separate. This is the work of children. And it's the work in our spiritual life too, to see what's healthy food and what's not, and give what's healthy to our inner spirit and child as well as to the outer. Is this clear to you? That's as important an aspect of love as that which holds a child in tenderness. To give attention and love is the first. To set limits out of love. To say no, separation. Wise discipline. And then the third is trust. These days, we tend to push children in our culture. And if you're interested in some interesting reading in education, read some of the... there's a psychologist at Harvard, at Tufts, named Elkind, who's written a series of books. The best selling of them is entitled The Hurried Child, but he has several others, Preschoolers at Risk, and things on critiques of our culture and education. And what it's about is the idea that we can hurry kids up and teach them reading early and teach them to ride their bikes earlier and teach them to be achievers, and we give them exams so they get in the right kindergarten and the right elementary school. And it's true in Marin County. It's absolutely true. It's competitive at that age, and it's crazy. And it's not just in that, not just in kind of the super kid mentality, but it's in television and advertising and dressing little kids up in fancy designer jeans and clothes that are really meant for kind of sexual adults to interact with in some way, to look fancy or to attract somebody else. And we make miniatures of them and put them on kids. Even when you watch television shows, generally, who's the smart guy when there's a show and there's children on it? It's the kids that are the ones that are supposed to be smart and kind of have the wise lines or the wise-ass lines, and the adults who kind of take it from them. There isn't much modeling for kids just to be kids. We want them to be independent. We put them in daycare and preschool, at times even when we don't really need to, instead of just mothering them or fathering them or taking care of them. There's a kind of ambition and speed in our culture that's put onto our children. And it deprives them of the most important thing they need to be a healthy adult, which is a healthy childhood. It deprives them of their childhood. Ambition. Or we get so caught up or consumed with our lives and our work that we're not really there to touch, to hold, to be with, to nourish, to play with our children. We're a very ambitious culture, especially at this time. There's a story of Mullah Nasruddin. He went to the court of the emir, of the kind of provincial leader, because he heard they were looking to hire some people, and he wanted some work. And he went in, and one of the consultants to the emir, this man who was one of the members of the court, received him, and this man was kind of interviewing those who might take jobs under the emir. And he said to Nasruddin, he said, "You've come for a job?" Nasruddin said, "Yes." He said, "We like really ambitious men here." And Nasruddin said, "Fine, I'll take your job." And the man said, "What, are you mad?" And Nasruddin said, "Is that also a qualification?" But if we look around at our culture and its values, there is a lot of that, of madness and of ambition. Now, here I've been talking about raising our children, and I would like to talk more about that some night and about education, because I'm learning about it. And to talk about it lets me understand it better, and I value it. It seems important to share. But I'm not just talking about our children. I'm talking about our society and our parents and how we were raised. And even more than that, I'm talking about our inner children as well, our spiritual children. For at the core of it all, what's not critical is the technique, whether it's Montessori or whether it's Waldorf school or open classroom or whatever, you know, or whether it's the breath or loving kindness meditation or whether you use mental labels or pay attention to body sensation. It's not the technique in meditation or in the classroom, child rearing, but it's what we communicate in some way from our being and our heart to that child and how much care we bring. That's really what matters. How caring is that person that the child spends time with? And that's true for our inner child. To bring a heart of confidence and compassion and freedom. These are qualities that the Buddha communicated to his disciples. A kind of groundedness, that there was a place to sit that no matter what arose, it was fine. A confidence. You want to communicate that to your child, outer or inner. A place of love that no matter what arises, it's possible to touch it with the heart. And if you work with that, to not be devastated, to learn compassion, to learn this universal power of our heart. So what's communicated inwardly or outwardly, it's communicated in our meditation. Yes, you can sit And you can open to what's pleasant and what's unpleasant, to what's sorrowful and to what's joyful. You can open even to the worst difficulties of your life. You can do it. You want to communicate that to a child, and you communicate it to yourself in practice. You can use your spiritual life, your attention, to find wisdom, to find balance. You can grow, you can develop. It's a lot like gardening. I've been talking about children, but I spent some time this weekend in my garden. It's the same thing. It's planting and mulching and working over the soil and putting in fertilizer and watering and taking off the snails and all of those kinds of things, guarding and nourishing the plants and letting them grow. Because the truth is that if children are held and cared for and loved with appropriate discipline and limits, they do grow. You don't need to teach them to be independent. They want to be independent. If you love them enough, then they feel secure enough to go and explore. They're not so afraid. There's a lot of spirit and passion when you work with children that you see. And our sitting and our working and our opening is to reclaim that in ourselves. So let me ask you some questions. What age is your inner spiritual child? Maybe he or she appears in a couple of different ages, sometimes very small, perhaps. Something for you to know and notice. This week or this month or this year, what's the predominant age of this spiritual inner child? Now, what does it need? What kind of nourishment does this child need? What kind of loving attention? How much time? Children take a lot of time, my friends. They do. And how much time does your inner spiritual child really need? What would nourish it to grow? What kind of food? What kind of place to be? What kind of discipline is necessary? And where's the kid getting in trouble? You know, or having too much sweets and too much TV and not enough of something else. You know pretty well. What kind of discipline would be useful for that inner spiritual child? Does it need more encouragement? More attention? More time with other kids who are interested in spiritual things? It's really to listen inside and see what could you do to nourish that aspect of your being, to bring it to flowering, to bring it to independence, to bring it to strength and freedom and happiness. There's a kind of a balance. Can you hear that? Now I'll read you a sutra from the Buddha. It's not on child rearing. It's a different metaphor, and some of you may have heard it before, but it seems somehow related. He says, suppose that a goldsmith builds a furnace, lights a fire in the opening, and takes gold with a pair of tongs and puts it into the furnace. From time to time, he blows on it. From time to time, he sprinkles water upon it. And from time to time, he examines it closely. If the goldsmith were to blow on the gold continuously, it might be heated too much and ruin it. If he continuously sprinkled water on it, it would be cooled. If he were only to look at it, the gold would not come to perfect refinement. But if from time to time this goldsmith attends to each of these three functions, the gold will become pliant, workable, bright, and will be easily molded. And whatever beautiful ornament the goldsmith wishes to make of it, earrings, necklace, golden chain, it can now be used for that purpose. Similarly, there are three qualities to which a meditator or someone devoted to inner training should pay attention from time to time. namely the qualities of concentration, of energy, and of equanimity. If we give regular attention to each of them, then our minds will become pliant, workable, lucid, not unwieldy, well concentrated. But if we should give attention exclusively to concentration, it's possible that our mind will fall into indolence or dullness. If we give attention exclusively to energetic effort, it's possible the mind may become restless or agitated. And if we give it exclusively to equanimity, it's possible the mind will not see clearly and bring itself to perfect freedom. So whatever we do in our practice requires a balance. To whatever state we wish to attain, we must look after this inner balance. So here we sit and do our practice, or we do it at home, or we do it at our work, our spiritual life. And the question really is finding this balance. And it's really the balance that I just spoke of working with the inner child. Energy or effort, that is the willingness to be there, to open to enter into our experience as we sit or as we work with another person, to really become present with our breath, with typing, with teaching, with gardening, with driving. To be there not just in body, but to have the body and heart and the spiritual child, the mind, all together. It requires the same fullness that when you want to be with a child, you have to give. Children know when you're only half there. And after a while, they start nagging you and kind of asking for things and stuff because you're trying to be there and read something at the same time. That's one of the ones I've tried to pull off with my kid, you know, or you're trying to be there and thinking about other things. And after a while, they say, wait a second, pay attention. So the first thing, that effort that the Buddha spoke of, is the willingness, it's kind of a brightness of our being, to come fully into what our experience is. And then that's balanced with concentration, which is that discipline, if you will, or steadiness. It's a collectedness or a stillness. It's not just indulging, I want candy all the time, and I want Caroline's, if she could have her favorite meal, it would be cake with icing, whipped cream, ice cream, honey, and sugar on top. And probably Coke or something like that to drink. And it's not that she gets very much of it, mostly at birthday parties. But she remembers those parties, I'll tell you. We hear about them for the weeks in between. And then, Daddy, do you know what we had after the cake? Anyway. So the element of concentration, this other part, is a steadying, a stillness, a collectedness, and not being scattered, a willingness to set some limits in a caring way for ourselves, in our outer life, through some spiritual wisdom, and in our inner life, not just to let the mind wander as it will, but to begin to train it and to still it and to focus it. So that we can see in a deep way what's here. First is to be present, and then second, in that, to work with the heart and the mind and the body, to steady. And then the third, again, the Buddha talked about equanimity, which is really the receptive quality. That's the quality that I call trust. To observe what's here, when you become steady and you're really present with it, then to observe without judgment. And this is where the letting be comes in. Because wisdom comes most deeply from seeing what is true and relating to that wisely. It's not so much changing ourselves, but the wisdom will grow as children grow, as independence grows, freedom grows, when we see what is true and say, yes, this is true, and open ourselves to relate to that. To relate to it with a caring heart, with compassion, with understanding that things aren't always cake and whipped cream and ice cream and honey and sugar and all of that. Things are not that way all the time. Thank God, actually. Even if it was all extremely pleasurable, you know what? You get sick of it. Remember that line from Ramakrishna, why is there evil in the world? To thicken the plot? But that doesn't nourish the heart. It doesn't raise the spiritual child in a way to find fulfillment and strength and steadiness and knowing. So it's balancing these qualities. And that balancing, that care, takes time. It takes listening. And it takes doing it. I mean, you can't raise your kid by pawning it off on somebody else. You don't get a very good kid out of it. This is Rumi again, many centuries ago, the great Indian poet who lived part of his time in Marin County. He says, these spiritual window shoppers who idly ask, how much is that? Oh, I'm just looking. They handle 100 items and put them down, shadows with no capital, no investment they make. What must be spent is love and two eyes wet with weeping. But these walk into a shop and their whole lives pass suddenly in that moment in that shop. Where did you go? Nowhere. What did you have to eat? Nothing much. Even if you don't know what you want, buy something to be a part of this exchange. Give yourself up for something. Start a huge, foolish project like Noah. You never know when it might come in handy. And I'll tell you one more thing. It makes absolutely no difference what other people think of you. They haven't been right before this, have they? Truth is perfect and complete in itself. It's not something newly discovered. This is from Zen Master Dogen as a way to end. It's always existed. Truth is not far away. It's nearer than near. There's no need to attain it since not one of your steps leads away from it. Don't follow the advice of others. Rather, learn to listen to the voice within yourself. Your body and mind will become clear and you will realize the unity of all things. In your meditation, you yourself are the mirror, reflecting the solution of your problems. The human mind has absolute freedom, and the human heart as well, within its true nature. You can attain this intuitively, not by working toward it, but by allowing the meditation to show you this freedom. There have been thousands upon thousands of students who've practiced meditation and obtained its fruits. Don't doubt its possibilities because of the simplicity of its method. If you can't find the truth right where you are, where else do you think you will find it? Life is short and no one knows what the next moment will bring. Open your heart while you still have the opportunity. You will soon discover a treasure of inner wisdom, which in turn you can then share abundantly with others, bringing them and the world happiness and peace. That was written 1,500 years ago or something like that. It seems rather current. The next issue of The Inquiring Mind has a series of articles on the relationship of psychotherapy and meditation, various teachers and psychologists are writing. And as I listen and people speak, I hear a lot of truth and very important things in the different voices, even though they may almost say opposite things at times. The gist of what I wrote about in my own few pages piece for The Inquiring Mind was looking at the limitations of meditation. as a psychologist also, and I admit from the beginning that I might be biased by having that training, but I have two sets of experiences that relate to that, to people's past, that are very compelling. One is I see a number of people as clients, not just from Vipassana sitters, but from the Zen and Sufi and Tibetan and various other communities, who've had a lot of benefit from their spiritual practice, and it opened them up and they changed their lives and found a kind of freedom that I don't think they would just have found by going and telling their story in therapy or touch something that was much more universal. But then I find a lot of people coming and saying, even so, there are these other places that don't work so well, that seem to be conditioned by the past. It's like these two pieces fitting together. Even more compelling, if you will, is to look at the group of meditation teachers, Zen masters and Roshis and Swamis and Lamas and Mamas and whatever, this, the whole, and being in that profession, I hang out with all these guys and gals, the guru set, and looking around, very honestly, there has been a major disaster at least half of the biggest Zen, Tibetan, Vipassana, Hindu, Jain, you name it, spiritual centers, and not just only among Asian teachers, but as much among Western teachers. There's been a major disaster primarily focusing around some big area of unconsciousness and power or sexuality or relationships and ability to listen or be intimate or money or one of those things in the majority of those places. So that's another side. That's a piece that... And so then it begins to get me asking this question, well, what... You know, what kind of freedom can you find or expect from spiritual practice? Or what things can psychotherapy or a psychological perspective help with that meditation can't? Or maybe there's some other dimension of life or in some way how they fit together. And I'm not even trying to present an answer right now, this evening. But just hearing these different sides and putting out a little bit more. It's very hard to look at parenting. What I hear also in some way is it's very hard to look at parenting and issues around it if there's guilt involved, if there's even the slightest blame that this is the way you should have done it. Because I think people care incredibly for their children, and they really do the best that they're possibly capable of given the limitations of the society and money and their own wounds and their own inner needs and so forth. And most of the parents I know really try. So if there's any blame, or if there's a sense, as Carol points out, that's it, you know, either you bond well in the first day or something like that, or you don't get into the right university, that we don't even, you know, or whatever it is, that it's over with. And that's certainly not true. There are all those stories in the times of the Buddha of people who were murderers and thieves who came and then heard some amazingly deep teaching and completely changed their life. You know? So to have the view that it's all bound in the past or it's all dependent on your parents, as a parent, I certainly wouldn't want that. On the other side, there's this other piece that our history does affect us a lot. And it affects most of the swamis and lamas and gurus and mamas and whatever in the same way that it affects us. And there's some wedding together that's necessary, some responsibility for the personal and the universal, to touch something that's greater, to act in the world in an ecological or political way that makes it different, or to find something that transcends our past in ourselves, that's really greater than that, through our spiritual life. That we're not limited just to this body or just our personal history in one life. And at the same time, to also respect the power of that which is personal and how it does repeat, and to be willing to pay attention to that part of ourselves as well as to that which goes beyond the limited sense of self.